does democracy look like?
Who should decide
your
that?
Own
the inventory of ideas.
Fairness for everybody.
From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's Democracy, a short history of a big idea, a special series from To the Best of Our Knowledge.
Ideas matter.
I'm Jim Fleming. This hour, Living Democracy. As a young man, Tom Hayden drafted a manifesto that launched a nationwide student protest movement and nearly upset an election. Pakistani rock star Salman Ahmad has risked his life to perform concerts in the Islamic world. English professor Azar Nafizi put her life on the line when she started a book club in Tehran that read Lolita. Computer programmer Ward Cunningham didn't risk his life, but he invented the wiki, an internet technology that's led to democratic uprisings all over the world. He did it for free. What do they have in common? They are living democracy. In this hour, we'll meet them all. They'll inspire us and they'll challenge us to live up to our own ideal.
To simply tell the truth.
An ideal.
Public conversation.
Closer to the people.
And first up, democracy, politics, and Pakistani rock and roll. You're listening to the music of Janoon, a band that blends electric rock with Pakistani folk music, with lyrics inspired by Sufi poets and the Quran. Janoon has been called the U2 of Asia. In fact, Bono is one of the band's many fans, partly because of Janoon's campaign for peace in the conflict between Pakistan and India. Janoon is also enormously successful. They've sold 25 million albums. They've also waded into Pakistani politics. One song about government corruption got them banned in Pakistan for several years. The band's lead singer is Salman Ahmad, who grew up in both Pakistan and America. Ahmad is actually a trained medical doctor. Some years back, he gave up his stethoscope for his guitar. He says music, like medicine, has the power to heal. And Strange Champs wondered how Salman Ahmad came to love music.
I remember when I was a child, growing up in Lahore, Pakistan, my mother had this huge LP collection, which had Bollywood film music, Qawwali, which is Islamic devotional singing, Elvis and, you know, rock and roll, and even Irish and Jewish music, folk music. So I think just listening to those diverse styles of music planted many seeds. And you know, they only came into fruition when I moved to New York when I was 11 years old. And I saw Jimmy Page at a concert, and I decided that that's what I want to do, is to pick up the guitar.
Now, you're also a devout Sufi, which raises some interesting questions about the connection between religion and music. I know there are a lot of Islamic leaders who regard rock and roll as the devil's music. How do you tend to respond to that criticism?
Well, first, let me just say, when you say devout Sufi, I'm a believer, right? And you can put a label on it, whether it's Shia or Sunni or Sufi. But being a Muslim means to one who has surrendered, you know, to a higher power. And simple as that, I'm a Muslim. And in Islam, there is a minority view that Islam prohibits music. And I've done a lot of research. You know, I read the Quran. There's nothing in the Quran, the Muslim holy book, which says that music is banned. Since the Wahhabi influence, the Saudi Arabian influence on Islam, they fund madrasas, so they kind of really discourage music and poetry. But that's not the case in the majority of the Muslim world.
Now, you made this really interesting documentary a few years ago called The Rock Star and the Mullah. You want to tell us something about that?
Yeah, it was a PBS wide angle asked me that they wanted to do a film in Pakistan and would I be interested in presenting it. And I got on board because I said, you know, what I'd like to do is to go through the country and looking at it through the prism of music. And in the north of Pakistan, where one of the religious parties had come into power, they had banned music in public places. Musicians couldn't perform. Some of them were being thrown into jail.
All music, not just rock and roll?
All music. In the end, there's a great sequence in that film where this one mullah that I'm having a conversation with, who had the more radical stances, you know, who said, no, you know, no music. Women should be at home. And, you know, adulterers should be flogged. And then After 2 hours of saying no, 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 and I was about to leave, he said, I hope you're not angry with me. And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, next time you go to the West, I want you to sing this. And he sang perfectly in key. You know, he sang this sort of devotional song, which once the cameras were off, I asked him, for 2.5 hours, you're saying, you know, this is prohibited. So he winked at me and he said, when I was a teenager, I used to be a singer and a dancer.
So. So what did you make of that?
Well, that people are in denial. There's a rigidity within the clergy and the mullahs, and also they're afraid of losing their gig. They see thousands and thousands of kids going to concerts, and, you know, MTV Pakistan coming in, and, you know, have private channels with all these young kids flocking to the music industry, and I think they fear that on the Friday sermon they're going to lose their demographic.
तन में तू है मन में तू है रूह के अंदर तू है तन में तू है मन में तू है रूह के अंदर तू है आस है तेरी प्यास है तेरी इश्क समंदर तू है साईं तू ही मेरा सच्चा साईं तू है मैं तेरा बंदा.
What we did in Junoon, what I tried to do was to take this popular form, which had always been associated with sort of just entertainment and, you know, love songs, and use Sufi poetry, which is traditional spiritual poetry, but at the same time very, very questioning, probing, and put that in a pop song. So that kind of, because it went out mass and it reached a younger audience, I think that created a lot of controversy.
Did you have some run-ins with Islamic fundamentalists in the early years?
Well, you know, interestingly, more political people rather than religious people, because the religious people didn't quite know what to make of us, because here we were singing the praise of Allah through guitars, drums. I remember this one concert, this was about 10 years ago. There was a lot of corruption during the time of Benazir Bhutto and Nawaz Sharif. Government corruption, and I wrote this song called Accountability.
No sir, na janab, ehtisab, bas ehtisab.
And we did a free concert in Karachi to raise awareness about accountability, and there were, you know, 20,000 kids were there, and what the politicians had done was they took the power away. In the middle of the show, you know, all the power went and you couldn't play. And the only place that they had power was this Islamic seminary. And so I jumped off the stage and I asked the mullah there, I said, you know, we're doing this concert to protest government corruption and, you know, we need power. So he looked at me and he said, aren't you the guy who sang the song Sai? And, you know, Sai is a metaphor for God. And I said, yes. So he told one of the students, give him a line. So it's a weird relationship, you know. Some mullahs actually feel that, you know, if you're singing devotional music, that's fine.
Wasn't that song, Accountability, isn't that the song that got your group actually banned in Pakistan for several years?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, pop stars or pop rock musicians were looked at like, you know, court jesters in the eyes of the establishment. Whenever there was like a national day, you know, they'd expect everybody, the usual suspects, to come and entertain, but to actually bite the hand that feeds you and say accountability. It was a turning point, I think, in pop history in Pakistan, that you could use dissent in pop music.
You know, one of the things that I think is so interesting about your music and about what you're saying is that themes of spirituality and of politics really run through your music and are all, you know, in some ways it's the same thing. And it's just very interesting. You sing a song about God, but at the same time you'll sing a song about government corruption that'll get you banned. Do you see a connection between these, spirituality and politics?
I don't see life in different boxes. I mean, in the Quran it says it's your duty to reveal the truth. I was influenced by the Beatles and, you know, John Lennon, and in the modern era, you know, U2, where they could balance both the spiritual and political comment, but do it in a way so it's not didactic, that it's entertainment, it's like an op-ed, you know? So I always viewed that in a country, you know, like Pakistan, where the literacy rate is so low, pop culture is a really powerful tool to spread awareness.
Was your music especially affected by 9/11? I mean, I'm sure it was, and I know you've performed at several of the memorial concerts, but I'm wondering, did 9/11 make you question any part of your faith as a Muslim?
You know, 9/11 kind of really put a microscopic focus on Islam and the Muslim identity. And because I grew up both in Pakistan and in America, both of my worlds kind of collided with each other. I just felt that, you know, Islam was being hijacked by everybody. First, it was hijacked by the terrorists, you know, who flew the planes into the building. And then, you know, this whole idea of a clash of civilizations, that Islam is a religion which is naturally violent. And I looked at my life growing up in Rockland County, New York, where I was in a garage band with Jewish kids, with Christian kids, and there was never, you know, we didn't live in the caves. We were in mainstream society, and my parents, my mother's a very conservative Muslim, but never, you know, were we ever told that, you know, that you're different or you have to grow up different. So 9/11, I think, first of all, I went inwards to study my faith better. And then I think the natural thing was to express it through music. So when I went back to Pakistan, I wrote some lines which I thought kind of take a dual perspective, both from the Muslim world and America. And we did this song called No More. That was sort of my reaction to it.
God and money take the blame. Suicidal video games. If all that lives is born to die.
No More is a song by the Pakistani rock group Janoon. The band's lead singer, Saman Ahmad, talked with N. Strange Champs. Before there was WikiLeaks, before there was Wikipedia, before there was Facebook and Twitter and blogs, there was a computer programmer named Ward Cunningham. He's the guy who, back in 1995, invented the wiki. He also did something even more radical. He didn't patent it. He passed up billions of dollars in potential revenue because he believed the internet needed to be more democratic. And why did he invent the wiki in the first place?
What I needed to do is I needed to find a way that somebody could write what they know, even though they knew what they knew was incomplete. So being able to describe the incomplete and make it useful. So I made it so that you could link to information that wasn't written yet. And HyperCard couldn't do that, but it had enough capability. That's the only programming I added to it, was an ability to look for something to see if it was there, and then tomorrow look for it again and see if it appeared. So you could write something and it would do searches to see whether it appeared or not. And that was an idea that was captured in WikiWikiWeb, although I did it with completely different technology. I had this notion that when you retrieved a page, I would check every link and see if it had appeared. And if it had, it was rendered as a usual hyperlink. If not, it was some different kind of link, a question mark, or I think on Wikipedia they use a red link in the typical form. Yeah. Red links versus blue link. Right? No point in pressing a red link unless you feel like writing about it.
So here you are, more than a decade later, and I assume you look pretty regularly at Wikipedia. What do you think of it?
Oh, I think it's great. I think what's best about it is that in addition to being an encyclopedia, it's a very effective wiki. And by wiki, I mean it's a place that can host a collaboration where people can work together even though they don't know each other, don't even know that they were intending to collaborate, but still find a way to work together.
Is that what happens when wiki works at its best?
Yeah, there's a couple of things that make that happen. First of all, being able to feel proud of what you can contribute even though you can't finish a project. So that partial work is important. But another thing that's very important is the idea that new places to write appear spontaneously. So you could be writing something and then all of a sudden you say, you know, that phrase I just used, that could be an article in its own right. And presto, it becomes an article. And it might be an article that's not written. It might be a red link, just saying there ought to be an article. But then you come back tomorrow and somebody started it. So that idea that the pages, you know, the number of pages in this book expand as need be. You know, when you start out, you know, maybe you only have 20 pages and people can read those pages and kind of know where they are. But when you need 21 or 22 or 30 or 100 or 1,000, it just grows.
But why'd you do this anyway?
The first wiki, I made it not because I thought we needed another collaboration tool, but I made it because I had a community of people who was trying to collaborate on email, and it wasn't working very well. And I said, well, you know, we're trying to produce a volume of work, and we don't know where that volume is going to go. The particular volume was we had a belief in computer programming that was not being addressed. So I was talking to technical authors, and we were going to talk about how computer programming really needed to be done. But we knew that we didn't have the whole story, and only by getting a group of people together could we actually assemble the story. And that took a number of years, but it came out very well, and it actually changed the way computer programming is done.
You know, one of the criticisms of wikis occurs to me here, because what you're describing is a community of goodwill. The wiki that you created so that computer programmers could work together to come toward an idea is the ideal wiki in many ways. But there are people who say, about Wikipedia, for instance, that it's dangerous. It's open. Anybody can contribute. Anybody, therefore, can put things in that aren't true, that take it in ways that it shouldn't go. Do you think that the wiki is inherently unreliable?
No, not at all. And I notice that most of the people who say that most vocally have some vested interest in controlling the definition of truth.
The people who run Wikipedia are also pretty careful to run algorithms that will get rid of the worst offenses anyway, if there are people who try to come in and attack, I gather.
To the degree that the computer can be programmed to recognize the intention of any author. You know, certainly if you show your hand by using lots of vulgarity, then it's easy to remove those edits. But if you're devious, you know, you could sway a lot of people. In fact, if you are sufficiently devious, you might change world history, and what you say might become true.
Oh. And that gives you a whole different attitude toward wiki, doesn't it?
Well, that shows you how flexible culture is. I mean, I think there isn't any absolute truth. I mean, we can say 1 + 1 = 2, and, you know, that's true in the plane. On a sphere, it's a little different. But, you know, in the world of our culture, we are what we believe we are, and it's ideas traveling through language that, you know, shapes our belief of what we can be.
Well, looking at the wiki, one of the great things about it, it seems to me, is that before the wiki came along, the internet was rapidly becoming an absolutely superb shopping mall. And the wiki opened it to discussion in a way that it simply hadn't been before. Do you think that wiki saved the internet?
Oh, I use those terms myself. Yeah, I think that a shopping mall is a just fine thing to do, but you know, at the end of the day, you know, there's just nothing more you need other than a little self-expression. And so, you know, we've had electronic mail and computer forums and stuff like that. The trouble is that, you know, that's just the spewing of half-thought-out thoughts. And I think for recreation, maybe we don't need to require more than half-thought-out thoughts, but then somebody else needs to be able to find those thoughts and finish them. And it's this idea that a wiki is timeless. It's a work. It's a product. It's not just the community. It's the product of a community. And that community, you know, molds it. But when the community leaves, the product's still there.
Ward Cunningham invented the wiki in 1995. He's never patented it. For more interviews like this, or for more background information, visit our new website. TTBook.org features 20 years of interviews, now available to stream download, and share. For To the Best of Our Knowledge, I'm Jim Fleming. This hour, Living Democracy, is part of our special series, Democracy, A Short History of a Big Idea, brought to you by Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
Support for To the Best of Our Knowledge comes from the University of Wisconsin Online Bachelor of Science in Sustainable Management, developing leaders with the critical skills to grow a green economy. Information is at sustain.wisconsin.edu.
You wouldn't think the novel Lolita would go over big in an underground women's book club in Tehran, but literature, like the people who read it, has a way of surprising you. Azar Nafizi is the author of the celebrated memoir Reading Lolita in Tehran. She was an English professor at the University of Tehran until she was expelled for refusing to wear a veil. That's when she began meeting with a few of her former students at her home every week to talk about the forbidden classics of Western literature. She tells Steve Paulson about the first time they met.
It was like, you know, thinking that you're in love, but you're not sure. I mean, I had dreamt of having a class like this for so long, and now that it was about to be actualized, I was both worried about how they will react to one another, how they will react to the books we're reading, will they come to the next session, and at the same time, I was full of hope. So I prepared for it the way you would prepare for going to your first date.
You read some pretty racy stuff, especially Lolita. I mean, this Nabokov story of this 12-year-old girl who gets seduced by this very urbane but smarmy man who is her guardian. That must have been pushing the edge a little bit.
Well, actually, it was amazing with Nabokov. And one reason was that Nabokov himself had gone through that experience of totalitarianism. Although he left the Soviet Union when he was 19, he was obsessed with it. Now, the story of Lolita, as we read it, was not just the rape of a 12-year-old girl, but the fact that Nabokov chooses a narrator and a seducer who is not, you know, who on the first impression, you, the reader, are seduced by him because he rapes Lolita more than seduce him. But we are seduced because he's a poet. He's a sophisticated man. And he justifies keeping Lolita in his jail almost for 2 years and raping her and, you know, having sexual intercourse with her against her will by saying that she was vulgar and that she seduced him. The point of Nabokov here is that the biggest crime is to impose your own dream, because Humbert Humbert had been in love with a girl in his childhood when he was 13, and he was trying to resurrect that girl through Lolita. The whole point of the book is that you cannot impose figments of your imagination on other people's lives, no matter how vulgar or mundane their lives might seem to you. And this is exactly what the Islamic Republic did to us. They imposed the figments of their imagination on us, saying that wearing lipstick was a crime. Now, we might like or dislike wearing lipstick, but no state can impose its own image of what I should be on me. And that is, I think, the point of Lolita. Nabokov was, I think, one of the most popular writers we read.
Now, one thing that strikes me as you're describing this experience is how intense it was. And I would guess far more intense than what you'd get in a typical English class in America where theoretically anything goes. I mean, you can say whatever you want in the class, but somehow it's just not going to be as loaded or as vital as it sounds like it was in your home in Tehran.
Well, you know, not just in my home. I had this experience also when I was teaching at universities in Iran. There was a degree of intensity and eagerness to their students' reaction to these books that I never found in US. And I think that their own experiences of life over there, being deprived of the most basic rights, of the most individual rights, made them so sensitive to these works, which opened a new window towards beauty and individual dignity and choice. Just the fact that an individual could write the way Shakespeare can or the way Nabokov did, I think, is a miracle in itself. And my students in Iran felt that miracle. Once I gave a talk on modern novel at Tehran Book Fair, and it became so crowded that the security had to shut it down. It was almost like a riot, you know. Where else in the world today can you give a talk about modern novel or Madame Bovary and have people up in arms, you know? So it was an exciting experience.
You tell some remarkable stories, both about what happened in this private underground group in your home, but also about some of your experiences at the university. For instance, how Scott Fitzgerald's The Great Gatsby ended up on trial in your class. Can you explain what happened?
Well, that was during my salad years, actually, my first year of teaching at the University of Tehran. I was soon expelled because I refused to wear the veil that they meant mandatory. And I was teaching a book on great works of fiction, 20th century fiction. And actually, I was trying to be very fair. Along with Fitzgerald, I had people whom I really didn't like Maxim Gorky, even the Marxist Russian writer. But one day, one of the leaders of the Muslim Student Association, he stopped me in the hall and he told me how he hated Gatsby. And he went on ranting and raving about the immorality and decadence of Gatsby, and that we had just had a revolution in order to wipe these people out, and I was bringing them back. And I thought that, well, I was not about to give in to his demand, but I wanted also to not just use my authority as a teacher and say, no, you know, I'm going to teach Great Gatsby no matter what you say. At that time, we still had some liberties which were soon taken away from us during the Cultural Revolution. So I decided that I will give him a chance to bring this to the class, and I decided that we'll put Great Gatsby on trial. And he became the prosecutor, and a wonderful, yeah, it was wonderful. I mean, he was in such an awkward position, you know, because he didn't expect this. But now he had to become the prosecutor, and one of my wonderful girls, whom I never saw after that year, she became the defense. And the class forced me to become the book. The defense. They said, you chose it, so you'll become the defense. And which we put Great Gatsby on trial.
So how did that work? how did the case for the prosecution proceed?
Well, I mean, I know I'm biased, but he ranted and raved, and basically he was saying that Gatsby was propagating an adulterous relationship, and that was immoral, and that was a sign of American decadence. And also the fact that he kept saying, and one other student whom we had asked to be the judge kept saying that Fitzgerald loved the wealthy and he liked the rich people and he was against the oppressed. And the argument against it was that a great book goes sometimes even against the desires and aspirations of its own author. And no matter how much Fitzgerald in his own life might have loved wealth, in The Great Gatsby, the biggest villains in the book are Tom and Daisy Buchanan, because they're careless people, because they force others to clean up after the mess they make. And this is the essence of The Great Gatsby.
So how did that episode end in your class? How did the trial of The Great Gatsby end?
Well, first of all, it became really heated. I mean, I gave them the defense and the prosecution kept interrupting one another, and you know, it became a shouting match, and I gave them a break. And I remember when I came in, they were still at it, and the girl was saying that, you know, you don't understand, I don't remember exact words, anything about freedom, because you call me a whore. And he was really mad, but what she was saying was true, because they were saying that any woman who did not dress or who did not act according to their dictates was a prostitute, was spreading prostitution. And others got involved in the story. And at the end of the class, she got up and she said that the most important thing she got from Great Gatsby was the pleasure of reading The Great Gatsby. And isn't that enough? And she asked the question whether when we read Moby Dick, do we go whaling? And when we read Great Gatsby, do we all run and become adulterers? That this is not the point of a great book. that it creates a dimension in us, creates a space in us that we've never had before.
Azar Nafizi is the author of the celebrated memoir Reading Lolita in Tehran. She currently teaches literature at Johns Hopkins University. Steve Paulson spoke with her. Many things can evoke a memory, like a smell or a touch. When Mameh Khadim wanted to evoke the memory of her native Iran during the Islamic Revolution in 1979, she did it with music. Her project began when a friend in Tehran needed a soundtrack for an art installation commemorating the anniversary of the revolution. The exhibition included a photo of a baby in a bassinet with the hand of a mother rocking it. Khadim immediately thought of lullabies, and then of songs of the revolution, songs from the left and the right that were sung in the streets during the revolution. So she combined them with traditional lullaby tunes. Here's Mameh Khadim talking with Anne Strainchamps about Goodnight Songs of the Revolution.
It's amazing because many of the Iranians have chosen to forget these songs, but they're all there. They're all in our minds. These are songs that, to some extent, you can say has awakened a generation and at the same time has put to sleep another generation.
Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar, Allahu
In the art installation, you sang the songs, We Hear Your Voice, but you sang them as lullabies.
The fact that the songs are sang by a woman is significant since women are not permitted to sing in public in Iran. So that was very important that I wanted to be that woman to sing the songs. Originally, these songs are very masculine. You hear mostly men on them. The second thing is that we wanted it to be with a different tone of voice, more or less like a mother singing to put her child to sleep. Softly, I wanted it to be sincere. I wanted it to be very simple.
قسم به اسم آزادی به لحظه ای که جان دادی.
These songs do represent the collective memory of Iranians during and after the revolution, and they have been burned in our memories from a very emotional time in our history.
You know, the whole time I was listening to these songs, I kept thinking about this. There's a line from a poem. You hear the line quoted a lot. Hardly anybody remembers the poem, but the line is, the hand that rocks the cradle is the hand that rules the world.
That's fantastic. And that's the hand of a mother.
ای شهید همه ببیش همه ببیش به یک صدا جاویدان ایران عزیز ما.
We should talk about the lyrics of the songs, what the actual words are. Some of them, they're really interesting in that a lot of the lyrics are about springtime, except so there are these images of flowers and trees budding, interspersed with other images of blood and guns. It's a really kind of chilling juxtaposition. But was
exactly.
Was it inspiring at the time?
Yes, it was. I think at the time it was very inspiring. I think that many people who sang these songs, they truly believed in the power of the words that are behind these songs. You know, I think people sang it with all their hearts.
چو در جهان قیود بندگی اگر فتت به پای مردمی به دست توست به رأی مشت توست رهایی جهان ز طوق جور و ظلم بپا کنیم قیام مردمی رها شویم ز قید بندگی چو در جهان قیود بندگی اگر فتد به پای مردمی به دست توست به رأی مشت توست
I don't know the lyrics, but the tune is from a chant. I've heard at dozens of protests in the West.
Yes, yes, bravo. It was done by this Chilean composer. And the words that you probably have heard in the streets of downtown LA in all the protests, and it goes like, El pueblo unido jamás será vencido. And I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing this right, but this is what I've heard. And that is, the people united will never be defeated.
Could we end by asking you to sing a song for us? Something maybe that would take all Iranians back to 1979, back to the revolution?
Yes, I would like to do that. I chose a song that's called Happy Spring. It was a period of time that all the factions were aiming to create a utopia. And that was the first time and probably the last time that so many diverse groups united. And that's the significance of this song for me, that everybody sang it. It didn't matter if you were a leftist or a rightist or fundamentalist. Everybody sang this song. And in a way, I chose it for that purpose.
And what are the words?
The words are as follows. The air is fine. Flowers have sprung from the ground. The swallow returns to sing of hope. Blood is boiling in the veins of leaves. Happy spring. Spring comes with grace. To family, friends, and loved ones. To eagle-eyed men who fight for us. To those who ride on liberty. Happy spring. Happy spring. هوا دلپذیر شد گل از خاک بردمید پرستو به بازگشت زد نغمه امید به جوش آمد از خون درون رگ گیا بهار خجسته باز خرامان رسد زرا بهار خجسته باز خرامان رسد زرا به خیشان به دوستان به یاران آشنا به مردان تیز خشم که پیکار می کنند به آنان که با قلم تباهی دهر را به چشم جهانیان پدیدار می کنند بهاران خجسته باد بهاران خجسته باد بهاران خجسته باد
ممخ کدم singing from Goodnight Songs of the Revolution. And Strainchamp spoke with her. How are you living democracy? Please go to our website at ttbook.org and tell us. And while you're there, you can also stream, download, and share TT Book shows and interviews covering the past 20 years. For To the Best of Our Knowledge, I'm Jim Fleming. This hour, Living Democracy, is part of our special series, Democracy, A Short History of a Big Idea, brought to you by Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. ¶¶ Tom Hayden was a founder of Students for a Democratic Society, and later one of the Chicago Seven, the men charged with, and later acquitted, of conspiring to incite a riot at the 68 Democratic Convention. In the 1980s and 90s, Hayden joined the political mainstream, serving in California's State Assembly and Senate. Tom Hayden stopped by our studio to talk with Steve Paulson about the legacy of the 60s.
I often wonder if I was 5 years older, I'm 67 or thereabouts, whether I would have missed the 60s. It happens that I graduated high school the year that Kerouac's On the Road was finally published. It was also the year of the Little Rock school integration at the point of federal troops. It was 2 years after the Montgomery bus boycott. I think those were precursors of the 60s.
And then Kerouac's book, that had a big impact on you, didn't
it? It had a big impact on everybody. I was part of the hitchhiking generation, but by its very nature, it didn't organize a generation. It touched the feelings of isolated individuals, as did the character Holden Caulfield in Catcher in the Rye, who, as you recall, thought the whole world was a mess. And you find out at the end of the book that he's in a mental institution. Mm-hmm. I felt like that. And I came out to California as a student editor, and I interviewed Martin Luther King on a picket line. I was still more drawn to a career in journalism, so I was thinking in terms of how the interview with King would get me on the front page of the Michigan Daily, more than to be a suggestion that I should put aside the pen or pick up the picket sign or both.
You were the observer rather than the activist.
I was a kind of observer, I'm ashamed to admit, but I went with students that year to Fayette County, Tennessee, because of something I'd read about sharecroppers displaced from the land, and we brought them food. And that's where I encountered the first sheriff coming up out of the darkness, and my knees buckled, and we were run out of town by maniacs with chains and clubs. And all of these experiences were personal, but also, and I don't want to dwell on it, but I mean, it was quite an incredible time. You know, you had the Cuban Missile Crisis, the Berlin Crisis, which brought the nuclear dread right home. We were closer than ever since to an actual nuclear war. That got into your bones. We were all draft age, too. But things were happening. Rachel Carson wrote Silent Spring. Betty Friedan wrote Feminine Mystique. Ralph Nader wrote Unsafe at Any Speed. Franz Fanon wrote The Wretched of the Earth. These books all were published in the space of about 1 year, 1961, 1963. SDS, Students for a Democratic Society, was formed. This was the blossoming of what I thought must be a social revolution.
Mm-hmm. Let me take you back to 1962 when you and your fellow SDSers.
As long as you know that's 45 years ago. We're still talking about something that happened a very long time
Absolutely.
Ago.
Absolutely. Which has been immortalized in various
Not
books.
Not quite.
The Port Huron Statement, you were the lead writer of that statement. I mean, it has turned into one of the most important political manifestos, I think it's fair to say.
I'm not sure. I would say it's an asterisk for a generation, but
when you look back on that document, how well do you think it still holds up today?
Well, it's got all of the strengths and weaknesses of sophomoric writing, basically. I mean, there's a huge amount of utopianism, idealism that only a young person could have written it. If you looked at it, this is not Karl Marx. This is not C. Wright Mills. This is not John Dewey. This is a self-confident generation finding its voice, really.
And to some degree, rejecting an older generation of leftists, too.
No, there's a generational friction that I think accompanies all these movements. I regret it because it means that the older left had been broken by McCarthyism. It's not entirely a good thing to be new, because it means your predecessors have been completely displaced. The other thing about the Port Huron Statement that I do think is lasting is the notion of direct action or participatory democracy as an alternative to merely voting.
So democracy at that time meant you went to the polls, and that's what it meant.
Well, it meant more than that, because I couldn't vote. I could be drafted. Blacks in the South couldn't vote. So getting the vote was no small matter, but it was more than getting the vote. It was extending the opportunity to have a voice in decisions beyond the ballot box to the community, to the university, to the workplace.
So where did leadership fit into this whole idea of participatory democracy? I mean, your movement back in the 60s still needed leaders. You were one of them.
The easy answer is that leaders should be elected and rotated and held accountable. And even that is problematic. But there's a role for leadership, but too much of history is considered in terms of leaders. I cringe at things I'm blamed for and things that I'm given credit for. It's all part of the inflation of the individual.
And give me an example of that.
The Port Huron Statement is kind of in between. It is true that I wrote a very long single-spaced draft. It is also true that about 65 people sat for 5 days in small circles, breaking it into component chapters and reconceptualizing it, and then voting on it, and then turned it back to me for a final polish. So do I get all that credit, or does the larger group get that credit? Those are the kind of things that make me cringe.
Now, when you look back on what happened later in the 60s, and particularly your own involvement in the 60s, you were certainly one of the most visible activists during that time. Do you feel like you more or less lived out the principles that you had spelled out in the Port Huron Statement?
Awkwardly. For instance, I've always had an extreme ambivalence about the question of leadership. And I've come to believe that it could be my weakness, can't resolve it, or it could be that it's simply not resolvable given my other beliefs. Sometimes, you know, it's not resolvable because in the electoral system we have, if you want to run for office, you're naturally going to inflate yourself. You know, you're going to take credit for things. You're going to want your name on bills because you can't go to the voters and say, I don't do anything because I don't believe in leadership.
Right. And spoken by a former politician.
Right. So, you know, it's kind of the system imposes certain penalties in life if you choose, for instance, to become involved in politics.
Well, I know to bring our story even closer up to the present here, you teach college students today. I'm sure you give a lot of talks at colleges. What's your sense of how today's activists compare to the way you folks were back in the 60s?
Today's activists as opposed to today's students?
Well, I'll leave that open to your interpretation.
Well, I think that the 60s caused a lot of reforms that have become part of the status quo. The free speech movement, you know, that started over the placement of tables.
I didn't know that.
Yes, it started over moving tables from Sproul Hall to Bancroft and Telegraph and so on. I don't think that a university would be foolish enough to ignite anger over an issue like that, although they're capable of foolishness. I understand that. What I'm saying is that the universities have now become like a soundproof room where it's really hard to shout and feel that you're being heard. You can read Leon Trotsky if you wish. You can read Che Guevara's diaries. You can unearth feminist treasures. The stuff that was forbidden in a time when that was synonymous with it must be radical or revolutionary, the forbidden is now permissible. Secondly, the draft is gone, and there's nothing to get your attention like a military draft. It's an unbelievable existential crisis when you're in that young and transitional period. And the other thing that's not given much attention is, you know, I went to the University of Michigan for $100. I can't remember if it was $100 a year or a semester.
Cheap, in other words.
Yeah, we had an idea like they have in France, in Mexico, in most civilized countries, that higher education should be free, state subsidized, a state investment in the future. Kind of like Social Security for the elders and free college education for anybody who wants it and is qualified for the youth. Now, it's been brought under the forces of the market where students are, their discretionary time is rationed out very carefully. The competitive stakes are very great when you're trying to get in. I don't remember anybody in my generation having to apply to 25 colleges looking for the good fortune of being admitted to one or two. Now we have a market model, not completely, but a market model that's displacing the old model of college funding, and that's got to have an effect on behavior, and it's got to induce more apathy than alienation, I would think.
Which is interesting, because I know apathy was one of those words that you and your fellow activists back in the early 60s railed against.
Well, yeah, we railed against it, but remember, we had discretionary time. I could drop out of the university and nothing would happen. I could go to jail in Mississippi, nothing would happen. I could return and pay my $100 and get back in. This is a treadmill that today's students are on that we didn't face. We thought our life was, you know, the future was a treadmill, the gray flannel suit and all that, but nothing compared to the pressure on this generation of students.
Tom Hayden, talking with Steve Paulson. Hayden was one of the founders of Students for a Democratic Society, and later, a state assemblyman and senator in California. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. This hour is called Living Democracy. It's part of our special series, Democracy, A Short History of a Big Idea, brought to you by Wisconsin Public Radio. Our series is produced by Charles Monroe Kane, with the help of Veronica Rickert, Anne Strainchamps, and Doug Gordon. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. Steve Mullen at Walk West Productions wrote the series' theme music. For more information on this series, please go to our website at ttbook.org, where you can also stream, download, and share TT Book shows and interviews covering the past 20 years. And today's last word goes to Canadian writer Margaret Atwood.
Nobody can predict the future, but let us just remark that Jean-Jacques Rousseau, who wrote the very influential book The Social Contract, which was used extensively by the men putting together the United States Constitution, what he said was, democracy is the hardest form of government to maintain. So I think we should all keep that in mind, that it requires a lot of maintenance. And it is like a muscle, use it or lose it. So if people don't care about it, and if they, for instance, stop voting and stop taking an interest in the decisions made by their various governments, it will slide even further towards oligarchy and autocracy, because you don't want to end up with the Star Chamber, the Bastille, the Spanish Inquisitions, or any of those other institutions that depended on secrecy.
PRI, Public Radio International.